I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hello and welcome to a series of new shows here on Love Sport Radio. Barkley and Barton on Manchester United. Over the course of the coming weeks, we're going to be deep diving into a post-war history on the Red Devils, ranging from today's episode on Sir Matt Busby and Jimmy Murphy, all the way through to the current state of play at Old Trafford and that much talked about post-Fergie era. I'm Matt Beadle, here to act purely as a conduit, a funnel for the treasure trove of tales we're about to hear from Messrs. Wayne Barton and Patrick Barkley. That is Wayne Barton, Manchester United author and historian. Hello, Wayne.
Hi, Matt. How are you doing?
Yes, very good. Thank you. Delighted to be here. Delighted to have you here in the studio alongside none other than Mr. Paddy Barkley, renowned, but I should say very much retired sports journalist and writer of numerous books, including autobiographies on former United managers, no less, Jose Mourinho, Sir Alex Ferguson and Sir Matt Busby. Hello, Paddy.
Hi. Yes, retired due to public demand, but still here to talk about Manchester United in this. I mean, we're in a pretty ambitious project here, the post-war history of Manchester United right up to the present day, but I'm really up for it and I know Wayne is.
Okay, without further ado, let's get straight into it. Episode 1, Busby and Murphy.
This is Love Sport.
An unbreakable pair, you might say, with each other for an eventful 30 years from 1946 to 1976. Now, Paddy, the armchair United fan tends to know plenty about Sir Matt, but Jimmy Murphy, perhaps not so much. And this was a gent, unbeknown to many, who would prove to be crucial to the future of the club.
Yeah. Well, Busby did say that Murphy was his greatest signing, and it was certainly his first. He wasn't even manager of Manchester United when it happened during the Second World War. Busby had a relatively cushy war, playing for, indeed player managing, a team of star footballers who went around following the troops to the theatres of war, including the Western Desert, and entertaining them, relieving the tragedy and drudgery of war with good top-class football. And it was during those travels that Busby spotted Jimmy Murphy, who at that time was a professional footballer and also working in a reasonably cushy job, although he was close to some really horrible fighting in the Western Desert. And it was during one of those tours on the Adriatic coast of Italy in Bari, where Busby happened to be there with his team, and he listened to Murphy coaching a team of soldiers, and he listened to the way he was trying to impassion these players and make them want to win the game and love the game of football. Busby was transfixed as he listened to this, and he had a tea with condensed milk or whatever that was available to the military in those days with Jimmy Murphy, and they became friends. Before that, they'd been adversaries on the field, and Busby had the bruises to prove it. But they became friends, and in one of the meetings, I don't know how many it took, two or three, I think, Busby said, "I'm going to be a manager one day, and when I am, I want you to be ready to join me as my assistant." I mean, it was as simple as that, basically. And just a few conversations about football and the philosophy of football and listening to the inspirational way he could teach it. He later, I think, compared Murphy's sort of Welsh delivery with the presence of the great actor Richard Burton. Which is not a bad knack to have if you're trying to teach people and fill them with passion. And he was as good as his word. After he didn't know he was going to be written to by Manchester United, let alone engaged by them. But wherever he'd gone as a manager, he would have taken Jimmy Murphy. Manchester United were just very, very lucky that they wrote to him first. Or lucky or inspired.
I mean, that's just incredible in itself, Wayne, right? The fact that it was a letter that started all of this.
Yeah. Just before Christmas, 1944, wasn't it?
Yeah. I think Jimmy had retired as a footballer. He wound down at West Brom, and then he went to Swindon on loan for a few games.
Oh, that's right. He'd left West Brom.
There was a great cutting, which unfortunately we couldn't use for the book, but it was a press cutting of his loan time at Swindon. So this is the 30s, mid-30s, and he'd had a shot from the halfway line, Jimmy Murphy, and... the thing about him was he was a wing half holding midfielder, very much the archetypal United player that everyone loves, you know, like the Nicky Butt, the Paul Scholes kind of tigerish kind of, the older heads would remember, you know, Nobby Stiles, Eddie Coleman, Wilf McGinnis, those kind of tigerish midfielders.
Yeah.
And that's very much what I presume Jimmy Murphy was in the 30s.
David McCreary, you missed that.
Yeah. Oh, well, I'm sorry, Weedy. But yeah, very much that kind of player that was beloved by United. And not a surprise, really, that we managed to produce that many of them with those kind of philosophies in place. Jimmy didn't really know what he wanted to be when he did retire, apart from, like, obviously he had to serve in the war. He did, for a while, consider teaching. His mother had been a teacher and always wanted him to be a teacher. On one break as a Welsh international footballer in France, he watched the great Jimmy Hogan coaching the Austrians, I think it was. And he was similarly transfixed with the way that I presume Busby was with Murphy, the way that Hogan taught football with the ball, training with the ball, which was, sounds stupid to say it now, but it's fairly revolutionary at the time. I worked with Gordon Jago a few years, the former QPR boss, and he always told me a story about Charlton, the coaching at Charlton, where he said they wouldn't give them the ball on the weekday training because the philosophy or the idea was you'll want it more on the Saturday, which just sounds ridiculous, like I said. But so he was transfixed by this idea of training with the ball every day, the virtues of hard work and being there for your teammate. And I think that's what Busby saw in Murphy.
Yes.
And the way that it was an effectively meaningless match between some demobbed soldiers that were just resting. But Murphy was treating it like it was a World Cup final. And I think Busby was inspired. He knew that, from what I understand, Busby wanted to have complete control wherever he went. But he knew that he would have to relax some of that control for an able number two.
Murphy was, and you know, less people who are probably being introduced to him through this, it's important to know, and Wayne has brought this out very, very well, that although Jimmy Murphy was a, you know, punching your palms, you know, come on, you're swearing, pint drinking, chain smoking, he was all of that, but he was also a very cultured man. He was very talented musician and loved classical music. He was a very textured human being, but as far as football was concerned, you know, it was passion. You know, he believed in that, and that's, as Wayne's just said, that's probably where the tradition of tiger, terriers, call them what you will, midfield players at Man United come from.
So what was it that made...
Matt certainly wasn't like that. He was a midfield player, but he was the complete opposite.
And the pair of them together, what was it that made the two of them such a formidable duo?
The complementary. The fact that they were opposites who had attracted and then were very... I mean, if you look at the great partnerships of that era, slightly later was Shankly Paisley, who did for Liverpool what Busby and Murphy had done for Manchester United. They were the same, but the other way round. Bob Paisley, who was Shankly's number two, was the kind, quiet, you know, restrained influence, whereas Shankly was the rasping, you know, in-your-face Jimmy Murphy character. So it was the same partnership, but inverted. If you look later, arguably, you know, up there with the greatest of all time, Brian Clough and Peter Taylor, they were like the Shankly Paisley combination rather than the Busby Murphy, where it was unusual for the number two to be the hard man, and Busby was the pipe-smoking, restrained one. That was how they worked, just opposites, but with exactly the same philosophy.
And the other thing with that was Murphy, I wouldn't say idolised, but he admired Busby as a footballer. And
Everyone was
more than happy to have Busby on the pedestal, which helped serve the idea that he was this godlike figure at United, which he became.
That was part of the thing. Yeah, absolutely. You've hit the nail on the head there, because Busby had this knack of being idolised. You know, I mean, we talked before about Bill Shankly, the founder of the modern Liverpool. Bill Shankly idolised, even though he was a fearsome man himself, he idolised Matt Busby. There are lots of anecdotes about that. There was one that Matt's granddaughter, Alison Busby, told me about when she was a little girl in the house in King's Road, Cheltenham Hardy. You know, as girls do, playing around the grandparents' house with friends or whatever it was, and the phone rang. And she happened to be racing past the phone in the hall when it rang, and she picked it up and hello, Lassie, and it was Bill Shankly wanting to speak. She says, oh yes, what can I do? He says, can I speak to Matt? Everybody, including the granddaughters, called him Matt. He was never granddad or anything, always Matt. And so she says, yes, certainly. Hold on, and put the phone on the table. And she ran off, and one of her friends must have distracted her, you know, by pinching her and running away or something. She completely forgot about this for about 15 minutes. So eventually she thinks, oh, no, there was that phone call from Matt. So she rushes off and she says, Matt, I'm terribly sorry, but there's a phone call for you. And it was a few minutes ago. So Matt goes, oh, don't worry about it. Goes out and picks it up, and Shankly's still there. Because he couldn't bring himself to put a phone down to the Matt Busby household. And there's another time that Shankly didn't drink alcohol. And he came round for, I don't know, Sunday lunch or something to the Busby residence, and Matt bought him a sherry. And rather than say, oh no, I don't drink, Matt, you know that, he drank it. It's the only drink he ever had in his life. But he didn't want to say no to Matt. It's an extraordinary. But that's the effect that Matt had on people.
Indeed, he did. What a great couple of stories to kick off Barkley and Barton on Manchester United here on Love Sport. Plenty more coming up.
This is Love Sport.
This is Barkley and Barton on Manchester United. And Paddy, moving on now to the team of 1948, marked really as the first great team of the club.
Yeah, known to among old-timers like me, although I don't really go back that far. I was born in 1947, but known as the 1948 team. And this is where Matt was lucky, in that Manchester United, even before he was hired, and went to them and said, I want to build a club, I want to build it on youth, all the things that Alex Ferguson later said. But even while he was developing that philosophy of building on youth, homebred youth, Manchester United were doing the same thing through executives like the secretary, Walter Crickmer, and a man called Louis Rocca, who I'm sure Wayne will agree with me, is fantastically important to Manchester United's history. He started off at a check in the gate, I think, at the old Newton Heath ground. He was a gate checker. He later graduated to scouting. He was known fondly as the fixer, you know, because he just did everything on behalf of the club. And he was a believer, as indeed it was laid down from the chairman, that they would concentrate on youth. And during the 1930s, a dark period in many ways, but a great period in Manchester United's history, where under Louis Rocca's leadership, they built up a scouting network, nothing like Matt was to do later, but they got their own players, and it was an extraordinary team. Players like Jack Rowley, who was a prolific goal scorer and, you know, one of the best strikers ever played for Manchester United, probably. Pearson, Charlie Mitten. He was a wonderful outside left who Busby was later to name in his all-time great Manchester United team. So that's how good he was. There was Johnny Morris, a young creative midfield player, an inside forward, as they were called then. There was a rare buy, which was from Ireland. Johnny Carey later became a captain, an incredibly intelligent player, and who was again fitted into a pattern in that the Matt's first great team was the fullbacks were converted midfield players. You know, he was a Pep Guardiola of his day, you know, in terms of the philosophy of the football. So he wanted creativity from fullback, which was heretical in those days. But there were, I mean, I can't go through the whole team because we just don't have time. But it was a wonderful team, and Matt balanced it. So Matt comes back after getting a letter from Louis Rocca just before Christmas, 1944. He pulls off his uniform and puts on a tracksuit and becomes manager, his war uniform, and puts on a tracksuit as manager of Manchester United. The first tracksuit manager, by the way. Before then, they would wear a suit and maybe a bowler hat or something like that. This happened, but he had a ready-made good team. So much so. Now, Busby was a good manager, but he can't just be genius management of Busby and Murphy that led that team that had never done anything, wasn't even the best team in Manchester. Manchester City was the best team in Manchester. Within the first season of playing in the top division after the war, they finished runners-up in the league. And yes, they were well organised by Busby and Murphy, but an awful lot of credit must go to Louis Rocca for signing them in the first place. They were young players, but they were old. I mean, they were in their late 20s, most of them, or early 30s. But really, this was a team that should have come to fruition in 1939, when they would have been in 24, 25. So that would have been, in a way, the first Busby Babes. But they lost 6 years, for 5 to 6 years, through having to serve in the Second World War. But they were a top, what we would now call a top four club, straight away. Mm. And it all culminated in 1948, just 3 years, less than 3 years after the end of the Second World War, in the Cup Final. This is why they were called the 48 team. They played in the 1948 Cup Final, which, okay, there had only been Wembley Cup Finals since 1923, but it was definitely considered the best. They played Blackpool, who were a great side in those days, but they won 4-2, a classic match. And that was Manchester United. In those days, the FA Cup was as important as the league. It was glamorous, more glamorous than the league. The league was a slog. It was great to win. And probably professionals thought it was hard. You knew it was harder to win. And it mattered more to them, but to the public. You know, if you could give them a choice between the league or the FA Cup, it would be the FA Cup every time. On TV, on Wembley, on the one good pitch in the country, you know. It's true, it was the one good pitch in the country, Wembley Stadium. So just to play on it was a thrill. Just to look at it, to look at a pitch in April that still had grass on it, was a miracle. At this great final for United, and when they got back, eventually on the Sunday night to Manchester, Albert Square completely packed, and that first trophy, I mean, even now managers talk about that first trophy, but how much it meant to Matt Busby and to Manchester United.
It might have been the celebration dinner of that time when Busby asked Murphy how everything was getting on in the reserve side. Yes. And Murphy said, I don't have a single player I can bring through to you. We need to change the entire system. But I think around that time, Louis Rocca died.
And by the way, that team was winning reserve, you know, it was a successful reserve team, that a successful youth team. But there weren't players that were good enough for Manchester United. That was what Murphy was saying.
And the other thing was that because they hadn't set up the FA Youth Cup yet, so there was no recognised competition for them to really prove themselves. I mean, this was around the time when Samat was... he was a revolutionary in so many ways, but one of his major ways was... He had an ambition of taking United to America and taking them to Hollywood and getting them to play in front of celebrities.
Which they did in the
They indeed did in the early 50s as well. So yeah. They were doing that. And behind the scenes back in Manchester, you had Jimmy Murphy. Like I said, I think Louis Rocca died around that time. And Joe Armstrong, who rarely gets mentioned, but he was so pivotal and crucial in many of the Busby Babes recruitment stories. And beyond that, you know, Munich and everything afterwards. Joe Armstrong, he had a similar scouting. He probably had more contacts than Louis Rocca.
As Louis Rocca aged, and was no longer able to scout, Busby had, and Murphy had to find somebody else. And Busby, who had played for Man City, remembered Joe Armstrong from City and remembers thinking, this guy's good. This guy's got what you need. And that was not only judgment of a player, but charm, a twinkle in his eye. So he was another great Busby signing, wasn't he?
When so much so that he adopted the name The Fixer after Louis Rocker.
Yeah,
he inherited the name.
That's right, yeah, he did.
What gets me is you mentioned these names, Louis Rocker, Joe Armstrong, and they were so pivotal in the development and the future and what became the Busby Babes, like you said, so on and so forth, to where we are now. And am I reading too much into it in thinking that nowadays you have the people behind the scenes that we don't hear about and they're equally as pivotal? Or back then, was it just more enhanced?
I think scouting is still important, but it's changed. To bring it up to date, Armstrong fulfilled the function that a head of recruitment would have now. And a head of recruitment doesn't work so much with mum and dads as agents. I don't think it's as good, but you know, life has changed. You know, a sport is now a very sophisticated industry. But yeah, I see the point you're making, that there will be heads of already they're starting to change clubs for large salaries. So it's you're not stretching a point at all. They're still very, very important. But it was so much simpler in the days when all it took really was time and persistence and judgment and charm, rather than the more sort of tawdry aspects of recruitment these days. Although Matt Wayne may argue with me on this, but Matt wasn't above breaking FA regulations. He always denied it. Almost his dying day, he denied that he ever bribed parents to get the likes of Duncan Edwards and the great player Bobby Charlton, who was a Joe Armstrong signing, to Manchester United. But he did find other ways of doing it. The players, Bobby Charlton included, Nobby Stiles, I think, as well, got nice little jobs in engineering factories south of Manchester, owned by friends of Matt and the club. And they didn't do an awful lot of work, but they did get salaries. So, you know, he had his ways of doing it.
And also in terms of how fortunate they were at the time, I think they were probably a little bit fortunate with the implementation of the FA Youth Cup, because it gave credence to what United were doing. Yes. Once they were successful in that, in the first season.
Also, all clubs saw what United had done and thought, God,
we want to imitate
this is it.
Yeah.
We want to imitate it.
Yeah, and they, United were successful. They managed to convince more great young players to come at that level, under the idea that United would improve them to make them the best players in the country. They pulled out all the stops to get Duncan, which was a real statement signing at that level, because he was the best young player and people wanted to play with him.
Wolves thought they'd got him, and Wolves were a huge club at that time, as big as United at least. Yeah. And he was on their doorstep. He was Dudley, near a few miles from Wolverhampton. And Wolves had been keeping in touch with him since he was almost out of nappies. He was a good player. He's as a baby, probably, Duncan Edwards. He was so formidable. But so obviously Wolves had kept tabs on him and just assumed he would go there. But they reckoned without that night. And Bolton certainly wanted him. Bolton took a lad called Parry, who had played with Duncan Edwards in the England schoolboys. And they'd signed him and put him in the first team at the age of just under 16, I think. And he was doing well. So they took him by car down to Dudley and got him to talk, got this lad to talk to his mate Edwards about how brilliant it was. You're getting the first team at Bolton and it's absolutely fantastic. And even that didn't work. And I think we go back to that 1948 Cup final. It was such a glamorous game. I know Bobby Charlton his head was turned towards Man United by that game. And I often think that Duncan Edwards's must have been, because he turned down all the blandishments and, for all we know, fridges and brown paper parcels that Bolton had.
Fridges.
by claiming that he was a Man United fan.
Yes, the magic of the FA Cup. Perhaps not as magical as it is now, sadly. True. But very interesting you mentioned Duncan Edwards there, of course, the birth of the Busby Babes and so on. We're going to be speaking about that and more here on Love Sport, Barkley and Barton.
I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Manchester United.
This is Love Sport.
It's Barkley and Barton on Manchester United. For this episode, episode one, we're delving deep into the hugely successful partnership of Sir Matt Busby and Jimmy Murphy, both as individuals and for the club itself. And Wayne, you want to discuss the small matter of a certain £200,000 boast made by Sir Matt during that time.
Yeah, because so it was the end of the 1952 season and the great side of 48 were ageing. And it looked like, you know, United were going to go through a period of turbulence. Thankfully for Busby and for Manchester United, Jimmy Murphy's work had been bearing fruit in the reserves and the youth team. He'd been getting the younger players to come through and they were playing a style of football that Jimmy was happy with. Jimmy's work there was to get their attitude right and to get them working hard for each other. Whereas when Busby got them into the first team, as I understand the work that they did, Busby would work on refining their game to make them the polished players that they were. But Murphy concentrated on giving them the raw ability to represent the club, which he did with astonishing success because, as Paddy said before, well, it was unheard of for a 16-year-old to break into the side, but Murphy was getting these young lads professionally ready at the ages of 16 and 17, whereas the kind of average age for a starting player coming into the side would have been 21 or 22. It really was that there was a learning curve.
Edwards would be the prime example, in that sometimes he wasn't available for the first team because he was playing for the youth team the same weekend. So he was actually playing for both. I mean, it's not unheard of, but it was in those days.
And around that time, Busby was questioned on, you know, what he was going to do in terms of moving forward with the side, what he would have to do to keep them successful. And he said, you don't need to worry about us. We've got £200,000 of players in the reserves. Mm-hmm. Now, the record fee, I believe, was Jackie Sewell.
Yeah, 32
or 34,000. Yeah. It was around that. So we're talking, he's saying we've got six or seven players.
Of the world record fee. So it'd be the equivalent now of saying we've got the best part of £1 billion worth of a billion, not £1 million, worth of talent in the reserves.
It wasn't even pie in the sky to him because he spoke in such a matter of fact way that it quickly bore fruit. Those players started to come into the side. Duncan Edwards is the prime example, but there were other players coming in, and they were because they'd been educated through that system and being so much better than the other teams, the other youth teams, they're so much better. There was one game where they won 23-0.
Yes.
Jimmy had a go at them at half-time because they were letting the foot off the gas. Yeah. He told them to go out and keep scoring, which they did. There were numerous famous examples of, there was a game I think they were played at Manchester City in the fog, a youth cup team game, and United were 1-0 down at half-time. And Jimmy was watching it from the sidelines, and because it was so foggy, he didn't know what to instruct the players. And Duncan Edwards just said, don't worry, just put me up front, I'll turn it around. And he did. It got to the point where the other managers or coaches of the youth cup sides would complain that they were playing Duncan Edwards because he was still eligible to play for the youth cup, but they were saying that was akin to cheating. But your likes of Bobby Charlton, who people think was a ready-made success in the youth team, he still had to go through a season or two in the reserves. And this is against seasoned professionals who are a bit begrudging that they're going on the outside of the game, so they're kicking a little bit harder against the, especially against these young upstarts who do they think they are, which gave them good grounding to get into the first team. So they were still getting into the first team at 18, 19, a lot younger than elsewhere, but they already had this seasoned profession. They'd already been hardened by the process, firstly through the school of hard knocks from Jimmy Murphy and Bert Walley, and secondly through that reserve experience, what they've been through.
With regards to this particular crop of players, there is always, it's not a danger, but I think often people talk about how good they could have been. Oh, when you just think of if that team had evolved, they just could have been world beaters. Let's focus, Paddy, on how good they were and what they achieved at the time. Of course, Real Madrid were, you know, dominating Europe at the time. And I had the fortune, actually, of interviewing Sir Bobby a few years back. And I said to him, I'm intrigued as to just how good Duncan Edwards was, because you hear so many stories, and I think it's far too many stories for it to be a romanticised myth.
Yeah.
I mean, this guy was a world beater.
Yes, he was. I mean, I think the perfect example, anybody listening to this can YouTube it, and I would recommend that they do. England played away in Berlin to West Germany, the world champions. Edwards got the ball around the centre circle, turned, and almost seemed to sniff the air and think, I fancy scoring now. He accelerated between two Germans who would, looked like they wanted to maim him, not just take the ball off him. He moved past those without even looking. He was just too quick for them. And by the way, these guys are world champions. Strides on, and as he gets to the edge of the penalty area, strokes the ball. I mean, effortlessly into the top corner. And if you watch it, the ball is down off the stanchion, swirling round the net, spinning out before the goalkeeper, who's diving, hits the ground. So that shot, which looked, and Edwards makes it look like he's stroking it, after beating two or three men, must have been hit with the most extraordinary power. And Duncan Edwards always had, you know, tree-trunk thighs. But that came through timing. The other thing, while I was researching this, I watched in, I managed to find a Pathé News clip or something like that. He hits this crossfield pass from what looks like about sort of deep right midfield to outside left. And again, it's stroked. And it's only when you think about it and watch it again that you realise it was 60 yards that ball travelled and landed right on the outside. The outside left might have been Albert Scanlon, might have been David Begg, I can't remember. But it landed on his toe. Bobby Charlton definitely said in his autobiography, he was the only player that made me feel inferior. And I think if you speak to Wilf McGuinness, if you speak to anybody who experienced Duncan Edwards, they all really say the same. That his death was obviously principally a personal tragedy for his family, but it affected the history not only of Manchester United, but of England, because he would still have been in his prime when England won the World Cup. Would they have won it earlier if he'd been in the team, given what he'd done to the previous world champions when he was a teenager? Would Bobby Moore have been the captain who lifted it, or would Duncan have lifted it? I'm sure Bobby Moore would have been in the team. And I think, Matt, you know, you're probably thinking, well, it's your romantic, not so much your memory, but your sense of romance getting the better of you here. I've examined that, and I'm sure Wayne has too. And the evidence is incontrovertible that he would have been one of the best players in the world.
Agree with that, Wayne?
It's important to, like you said, when we're romanticising the past, and United had, at that time, they had 10, so circa 1956, October 1956, they were embarking on the European Cup campaign. They were playing against Borussia Dortmund. They had 9 or 10 youth team players in the team and one signed player, which was Tommy Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
They were jam-packed with stars. And the crazy thing was about that, because they were so good and because they won the league title in 1956, it was seen not so much a sporting miracle, but complete vindication of what Busby had earlier said. It was no longer this handsome boast that he'd made. It was called calculated. ruthless. United were not just, they didn't just have eight or nine players in the first team. They had eight or nine youth products in the reserves, mm-hmm. eight or nine youth team products in, well, 11 in the youth team.
Yeah.
They were all of
that. Classic case was Jeff Bent, who couldn't get in the team. He was a, because he was principally a left back. And Roger Byrne kept him out of out of that team, the captain and a great attacking fullback. But every other club in the what would now be called the Premier League wanted him, and Jeff Bent wanted to go, but Busby would say, "Nah, you're all right, Jeff. Your time will come." And he was a perfect example of that. There were players in the reserves that would walk into most teams.
And Busby and Murphy were also, they were so concentrated on personal development of those players. Mm. Bill Foulkes suffered a dip. He was a fullback. He suffered a dip in form. So they put him back into the reserves to retrain him as a centre-half, which is, of course, the position for which he was
played
renowned.
And won the European Cup.
Charging in the semi-final as a...
scoring an absolutely striker's goal. So the other players said when they saw him galloping onto the pass in the Bernabeu against Real Madrid, they thought, no, but John Aston, the hero of 68, told me when we saw him striding onto that pass from George Best, we thought, oh no, anybody but Bill. And he tucked it in the far corner. And John Aston said, I think it was the only time he ever side-footed a ball in his life.
Bill Foulkes was an example of that hard work on the training ground, of the players, of the work and the commitment that Murphy and Busby and Wally would put into those players. And it was working perfectly. In the reports, what I read for the Borussia Dortmund European Cup time 56, United were described as the greatest team in the world, which tells you everything that you need to know about the standard of quality. And this is in the era when Real Madrid were the great European side. They were winning all those European Cups, and United were seen as the great challengers. When Harry Gregg signed for them in December 57, he described going to United as the Hollywood of football. Mm-hmm. And that's not because they signed every player like Real Madrid would these days. It was because they had this reputation for developing their own players, and they were still the best in the world.
Yeah, the crowds they drew away from home were testimony to that. I mean, there were a lot more neutrals who watched football in those days, or people of neutral disposition who might support a club but would see the attraction in others. And you'd notice that when the Busby Babes were in town, the away crowds were at places, you know, other big clubs such as Tottenham, Wolves, were full or overflowing. And, you know, with 10,000 locked out, it didn't happen every week, but it wasn't unusual. And it was the style of football, and as much as anything else, it was, you know, you have players like Coleman, they'd be doing back heels, the body swerves, and all sorts of finessing tricks that weren't prevalent to that degree in any other club.
And to that point, Gordon Jago, I mentioned earlier, he was breaking through playing against the Busby Babes side of that season. So 56-57 era was when Gordon Jago was breaking through himself. And they still weren't training with the ball at Charlton. Mm. That was the product of all that access to training with the ball all the time. Mm. The system that they had at United, where the players knew each other, they had this telepathic understanding of their positioning, mm-hmm. and the sort of the relationship and the internet connection that came from those players working through that system made it so easy for Busby to make changes, to bring in players like he could bring in a Bent for a Byrne, and it would be seamless. The great thing about it was they would always encourage those players to express themselves as individuals, so it wasn't... In later years, Liverpool would be renowned for identikit reserve sides, where the United players would even complain that the reserve strikers looked like Ian Rush. Mm. It wasn't like that for United. They still had their own identity, their own style when they were coming into the first team, and they were always encouraged to express it. And I think that's what made them so, like you said earlier, the tricks and things like that. Mm. They were unheard of. They were almost playing a continental style of football.
Yeah, absolutely. A continental style of football that would, to some extent, later become synonymous with the club. It's Barkley and Barton here on Love Sport. Do not go anywhere.
This is Love Sport.
This is Barclay and Barton on Love Sport. We are fast forwarding now to 1958, but just a very quick note that there will be a special episode in this series dedicated solely to the Munich Air disaster. That is, of course, a subject which requires far more time and attention as a standalone show. But Wayne, let's for now look at how Busby and Murphy went about rebuilding Manchester United after Munich.
Yeah, it's a curious one because I think both of them would have called it a day. That's my conclusion. Unwittingly, both of them convinced the other one to carry on. Murphy ended up, he obviously had to deal with a lot of things back in Manchester. For those who don't know, I know we'll cover it in the Munich episode, but he was left back in Manchester because he was managing the Welsh team to qualify.
Cardiff against Israel in the playoff for the World Cup.
Which they qualified for the first time in their history, for the only time for a major tournament until recently. So he'd been left behind. He actually did ask Sir Matt if he could travel with
us. He felt that his duty was to Manchester United, and Matt said, look, if anything goes wrong in Cardiff, you'd never forgive yourself. Yeah. So he agreed to stay in Cardiff, and Bert Wally had taken the seat next to Matt on the plane, which Murphy usually occupied. You know, that was how that happened. And Murphy came back, and I know we'll talk about Munich separately and all the ramifications, but he came back not knowing about the disaster and basically just had one whiskey-soaked night. Everybody drank for oblivion that night in Manchester. It was a terrible, terrible shock, and he just had that before becoming de facto manager of Manchester United.
He travelled to Munich to see what the state of play was. Sir Matt was gravely ill. As many people know, he was read the last rites. Was it more than once?
Twice.
There was no indication that the club itself was going to carry on. Jimmy, he went to Matt to see how he was, and Matt effectively whispered to him, keep the flag flying, is what he said to him. And Jimmy hadn't gone there thinking this is what's going to happen moving forward. He hadn't gone there with an idea other than supporting and being there for his friends. But because Sir Matt had told him that, Jimmy was hugely religious, so much so that in the aftermath of the disaster, he had a crucifix, which his sons say that he wore down to a nub. I think he wanted something to fight for. He wanted something to believe in. He wanted to feel that he could contribute when so many people felt helpless. And that's what Matt wanted him to do at that point. I think Jimmy did idolise Matt at that point. He'd built Matt up to be this godlike figure for his players, but he had been influenced by that himself. Yeah, he really did idolise him. So he said, I'll do that. In the sort of months that followed, Matt was very reluctant. He didn't want to go back, but I think he was... I know his wife had a huge...
I think Matt's wife was another fundamental figure in the history of Manchester United, because whether she believed this or not, or just was trying to get him out of his terrible depression, guilt, induced by guilt, he wondered if it was his fault, you know, that the plane had crashed and he was in pain. He'd cracked ribs and because of other conditions couldn't be given the analgesics to ease the pain. So he's in terrible pain, but it was nothing to do with the anguish, the pain of the guilt and the grief. And she decided, whether she believed it or not, she may well have done, Jean Busby, that the only way to get him out of it was to convince him that the only way to pay respect to those who had died was to come back and resume the team building. And bear in mind what Wayne said earlier about there was doubt that the club would survive. Damn right there was. Look at Torino, the greatest club in Italy, when their plane crashed in 1948, I think it was, and everyone was wiped out. Torino ceased to become a big club at that moment. They were even relegated a few times. Juventus became the biggest club in their city and remained so by a long, long way. So there was a danger that Manchester United would just go back to being, you know, a relatively minor club. And so Jean convinced Matt that he had to rebuild Manchester United as close as possible to what it had been. And that was a piece of emotional genius by Gene, because Matt believes it.
Yeah, incredibly so. And as we know, he did come back. Yeah. And I think he was so strongly connected to that European run as well. And as a result of him coming back and this unrelenting pursuit, I suppose, of Europe, which became less about that dynasty, but more about an unfulfilled destiny, which, of course, then in 1968 was fulfilled.
Yeah. Well, they started off by getting to the cup final in the year in 1958. But then he changed. He realized that I can't get young boys and develop them, Jimmy and I, in the way we have done before. And besides that, we haven't got time. He didn't know how much time he had. In the end, he needed 10 years, but we're fast-forwarding there. But, yeah, he knew he would have to do it by other ways, so he broke his rules and started breaking transfer records, you know, spending a lot of money because he simply didn't have time to do anything else. You know, Dennis Law came, and they still, you know, Paddy Crerant. They paid a big, big fee to Celtic for Paddy Crerant. Yeah, he did wield the checkbook in a way that he never had done before, because simply he had to.
I think Jimmy had said to him as well, I will deliver you one more FA Youth Cup winning side. Mm-hmm. He saw that as his responsibility. And I think that, in a way, sums up where they both were with it. Like we said earlier, they were looking to build a dynasty in the same way that Real Madrid had done. But their attitude changed after Munich, as it would, and it became more about achieving it once, at least doing it once more to say that they could do it.
Yeah.
And that would be the memory, that would be the legacy of what they do to honour those who died, really.
And they still had examples. I mean, Bill Foulkes and Bobby Charlton, thank God, survived Munich and were playing again within a couple of weeks, 3-4 weeks.
Yeah.
In fact, they were in the team that played in the FA Cup shortly afterwards. So he gradually, without abandoning the youth policy, in fact, when they eventually won the European Cup, there were, I think, about 8 homemade players in that team.
I think it's 8.
Because Dennis Law didn't play. Brian Kidd, who was homemade, came in. And so, you know, they did keep that, but they bought key players, and they bought the right ones. Dennis, who, although he didn't play in the final, was obviously fundamental to everything else that happened when he was on the pitch. Paddy Crerant, who was, the word servant almost sort of demeans his contribution, but a great contributor to the club, yeah.
Building a fantastic side, of course, on the precipice of European glory. 1968, Wayne, Wembley.
Yeah, United had had this fateful run. They defeated Real Madrid in the semi-final, which was obviously fateful and romantic in its own way because of the history with Real Madrid. They had a good history with Real Madrid after Munich, so it was fitting that they defeated them in the semi if they couldn't beat them in the final. And then they came up against the Benfica side, who mainly had most of the players that they'd already defeated. 5-1, Paddy, in the
George Best masterclass in Lisbon, where United won 5-1.
So that had been a couple of years prior to that, when George Best had been dubbed El Beetle. That, you know, that was his crowning night. United, I guess they were favourites to win against Benfica, but obviously it was a difficult game.
What made it more difficult was that United had just lost the league on the final day of the season, 4 days before. And guess who won it? Manchester City, with a thrilling 4-3 win at Newcastle.
Which is part of the narrative that never normally gets brought up.
Yeah, absolutely. So Busby had to lift the players.
And apart from Paddy rubbing the salt in the wound of the United fans there, it's important to note that, again, this is a pre-Champions League era. So this was very much, because United could only qualify for the European Cup by winning it for the following season, this was his last chance. That's what they saw it as, their last chance, because they didn't win the league. You know, for many players, one European Cup final is all you get. So there was extra riding on it.
Yeah, but they were still quite confident. They'd played, they thought they'd got the upper hand. They'd played them in a friendly in the United States during a tour, I think, earlier in the previous summer. So there was a fair amount of confidence, and it was obviously enhanced by the fact that the game was at Wembley. I mean, home advantage was huge. And if I may bring in another neutral note among you two Englishmen, the value of home advantage had been shown at Wembley, I think, in 1966, only 2 years earlier. So let's get that one out of the way. So I think that there was definitely a feeling that with the whole crowd behind them, that United really should win this. But as it turned out, they needed extra time.
They did. I think United played well in the game. John Aston was absolutely brilliant. If you want to see a masterclass in wing play, absolutely, watch John Aston in the 1968 European Cup final.
Even George Best had to play second fiddle as a winger that day.
Absolutely. He was absolutely brilliant. But United were leading. Benfica pulled it back. About 5 minutes from the end, Alex Stepney's forced into making a save, which isn't the most outstanding save.
No, it wasn't.
But
Eusebio would have called it a missed chance.
But it was a crucial save.
Yes.
Although his reaction, Eusebio, of course, his reaction at the time was, you know, very complimentary.
He went over to Alex Stepney and tried to pat him on the back. But Alex Stepney was in no mood for that, because during the friendly that I've just referred to, the previous summer in Los Angeles, I think it was, Eusebio had scored a couple of penalties. And each time he ran into the net, picked it out, and as he walked past, ruffled Stepney's hair. So Stepney was in no mood to have his back patted by... and apart from anything else, there was the counter-attack to set up. And I think Stepney immediately threw it up the left wing to Tony Dunn. I'm glad I mentioned Tony Dunn, because what a great fullback he was. It's worth remembering. He'd actually even put Eusebio off slightly when he hit that shot that Stepney made the alleged wonder save from. But anyway, Stepney said it wasn't until after the game, when people had said, oh, what a gentleman that Eusebio was, it was only then that he really thought about it and thought, yeah, it wasn't bad, you know.
The save was as good as a goal for United in terms of the way that it settled their mentality for extra time. You had Busby walking around calmly trying to assess the situation. You had Jimmy Murphy full of politically incorrect rants to the United lads, saying, come on, we've got them, they're dead, just kill them off. And they did. They blistered them in the first 15 minutes of that second half period. George Best, when he rounds the goalkeeper, what a fateful moment in United history, because he's just got to roll the ball over the line to bring destiny. You've got three United lads scoring, you know, that were developed by the club. Afterwards, after the game, showing his sporting side, Jimmy Murphy went into the Benfica dressing room to console the players, having just tore into them in front of the United players, went into them to console them and give them a drink from his hip flask, which he always carried around with him. I think for Busby and Murphy, they needed that vindication. The league championship and another youth cup was all well and good, but between them, they wanted a European Cup. So it was a magical night.
It was cathartic. After Munich, 10 years after Munich, it was, you know, nothing would ever make up for that, as Busby said. But, you know, as a consolation, it weren't bad, was it? And the funny thing is that Alex Stepney, the goalkeeper, said to me once that they never, in that 10 years, the players never spoke about Munich. They communicated about it mentally, because everybody knew it was there, but it was never spoken about. And funnily enough, Matt's son, Sandy, said, although, you know, no longer with us, he said before he died that it was never spoken about in the family. Although, sure, between Matt and Jean, of course, it would have been spoken about, but it was never spoken about to the family. And Stepney made the point that when the final whistle went at Wembley and United were European champions, first English club to be so, the players all instinctively went to two of their colleagues, and that was Bill Foulkes and Bobby Charlton, the survivors of Munich. And nobody said, hey, let's, you know, congratulate them. They just knew what to do. And they gravitated towards those two players, who were emotionally spent, of course. And that was it. All that was left was the celebrations. But it must have been... you could see in Bobby Charlton, as he sank to the turf, that the weight of history almost literally drove him into the ground that night. And it was interesting that Charlton, who was a very emotional man, absented himself. He didn't feel really well enough to enjoy the celebrations properly.
They were good celebrations, though, weren't they?
They were, and the wonderful thing about it was that Matt, who fancied himself as a singer, he at the party, Paddy Creran said that the last time he saw him at the party, he was singing the famous Louis Armstrong song, What a Wonderful World, and he sang it a few times that night.
This has been episode 1 of Barkley and Barton on Manchester United, a brand new series here on Love Sport. We'll be back same time next week, 10 p.m. on Saturday evenings. And don't forget, you can also download and subscribe to the podcast version of this very show by visiting lovesportradio.com. We'll see you next week.
This is Love Sport.